Episode 44. There's a lot of lessons learned here as I think back through this story and apologize ahead of time if I pause at times or try to think through it. I don't write all of this down, but just pretty much from memory. But there's some funny things that happened here. Kind of a background to this. A few years previous to this, I had been a part of inventing an underwater propulsion device, and we'd brought it back to the SEAL team as I thought it could be really useful for underwater operations, combat swimmer operations, as a mission enhancement tool. And so while the U.S. was looking at the technology to try to evaluate it, see if it's safe to bring onto the military, into the SEAL teams, that sort of thing, we still had to keep the lights on. And so we had to go overseas and be able to talk with other governments to see if they would be interested in buying it. Now, all this has to be approved through the State Department. And we were approved to go to Egypt to present what we had. And we were going to go there to do a big presentation. I think we're going to be there a week. And this is the story of that trip. Unbeknownst to us, or at least I didn't think of it at the time, there was actually a revolution that had happened just a few months prior to this. And so we landed there in the midst of that. So here we go. November 2nd, 2011. We land in Cairo Airport, a colleague of mine and all of our gear, to be able to meet up with the Egyptian government, the military, and be able to demonstrate this underwater propulsion device, which was called Jet Boots. Anyway, so we landed at the airport. I'd never been, shockingly, I'd never been to Egypt before, but right away we knew something was different. There wasn't barely anybody in the airport. The plane was pretty sparse. And what we did know at the time was Libya. Gaddafi had just been killed. If some of you remember the video of him getting strung out on the car, and really the citizens of Libya were fed up with him. And so they overthrew the government, dragged him out in the streets and shot him a bunch of times and killed him right on the spot. So we were landing in Egypt, which is view. Look at a map, they're connected together, but still separated. You still got to take a plane over to Libya. And I remember walking off the plane, I'm like, wow, there's not a lot of people here. Well, at least I'm pretty, I guess, dark-skinned, and I can kind of blend in as long as I don't talk. I didn't think it'd be very popular being an American there, but the plan was to meet up with our military escorts who would take us directly to the base, and everything would be okay. And I didn't actually land there with my colleague. He was on another flight coming in, I believe, a few hours later. And so I was going to go grab the equipment. And you got to go through customs and all of that stuff that you can imagine coming to Egypt. And I remember walking off the plane, and you have to fill out these immigration cards. And they're really kind of challenging to fill out. Obviously, they're in Arabic, and one side's on English, but still, you got to spend some time doing it. So as you get off the plane, there's a spot. It's not clearly marked. There's probably seven people on my flight. And I got to fill this thing out and kind of make my way through this, through the airport, which we haven't got through customs yet. So we're still kind of on the outskirts. And I'll never forget, I hear this American voice over my shoulder, and he says, "Hey, where are you headed?" And I turned around, because I wasn't traveling with anybody, but American voice turned around and said, excuse me. And, you know, he had kind of nondescript clothes on. He looked kind of frazzled, didn't know where he was going. And I didn't know if he came off my plane. I don't remember seeing him on my plane, but he could have been transiting from another plane. And he's like, "Hey, yeah, I'm trying to get to Libya. Are you going that direction?" And I remember thinking to myself, like, what do you mean you're going to Libya? Why would anybody in their right mind want to go there? Like, they're having their own revolution, let alone they just killed Gaddafi right in the streets. It's the last place I would want to be going. I was thinking, is he a reporter? Is he a, and I said, no, friend, I'm headed to Alexandria. I'm doing some other things, and I don't know who this cat is, but he kind of looked at me and was going to ask another question and then trotted off in the opposite direction, I guess to hitch a ride to Libya. Who knows? I don't know. I bet there was no flights going into Libya. It could have been an agency guy. I don't know. Maybe a reporter or something like that. Anyway, so I fill out my documents. I get through into customs and they kind of look at me like, well, I'm pretty dark skinned anyway, dark hair, all of that. But with American passport, like, okay, what's your business here? And it's funny in some of these other countries that I've been to, immigration or the passport checkpoint is kind of a fluid thing sometimes. And the person checking my passport, the officer there was kind of looking me over. I had all these military style cases that held all of our equipment. It looks like an arms dealer almost, which I guess you could consider me one, really. We're selling underwater diving equipment to the special forces. And yeah, so we're selling equipment to foreign military. And that's basically what I told him. I'm linking up with, I gave them a name. He kind of didn't know who that was, but that over his shoulder, I heard a whistle and the guy turned around and I looked over and the guy ran up from on the other side of the checkpoint and kind of whispered in his ear. And I remember he didn't even stamp my passport. He just kind of gave it to me and said, you can go. And I don't know. Every country I've ever been to, you got to stamp your passport. Like, if you don't have an entry stamp, you're not going to get out of countries. And I was going to protest, like, well, wait, but just let me get that stamp. And whoever the guy was, grabbed my passport and I was kind of with him now. And already my spidey sense is going up. I'm like, oh, good grief. Breaking rule number one. I'm linking up with somebody I don't know. Doesn't seem like they speak English. He now has my passport in his hand and I got quickly through customs. This is not going well. Anyway, we link up with a couple guys that were dressed in military uniforms. So I was like, much better. But then they kind of disappeared. And I was trying to tell him, hey, I have my other colleague. He's coming off the plane. I got more gear. Somehow he understood. And my colleague came off the plane and he steps off the plane. And he's like wearing a suit. I'm like, oh my gosh. If anybody stand out like a sore thumb in a foreign country, why don't you wear a suit? And he gets through customs. We get handed off to somebody else. I don't see the military people there any longer. And so my spidey sense goes back up like, hey, where are the military guys? That's our escort. My colleague is, I don't know. I think he's well traveled, but he doesn't seem too concerned. In my mind, it's kind of racing because they're grabbing our bags. They're grabbing all of our stuff and they're kind of just quickly shuttling us over to a vehicle. And my brain is like, don't get in the vehicle. Don't get in the vehicle. Like, what are you doing? You never have somebody else choose where you're going to go or what vehicle you're going to get in. You kind of do that yourself and you set it up ahead of time. Well, my alarm bells are going off. My colleague's like, yay, all right, my friends, give him a big hugs. He doesn't know them either. I know that. This is the first time we've been there. He hops right in this car. It's not a taxi. Didn't have Uber back then. It's just a beat up piece of crap car. All of our Pelican cases, which are these hardened plastic cases with all of our equipment in it, they're trying to shove it in the back of it. It doesn't really fit. And for some reason, we're in a big rush. And if you can imagine that whole scenario, I'm outside, I'm sweating. I'm like, oh, good grief. This is not going well. I don't know who these people are. We're getting shoved into a vehicle really quickly by somebody I don't know. In these Middle Eastern countries, everybody says, oh, yes, everything will be okay, God willing, inshallah. And the last thing I could remember doing, and I was like, I can't do anything. Well, hey, I need to get into my bag, because in my check-on bag, I had kind of a small kind of like a passport holder where you put it around your neck and you can put it under your shirt and kind of tucked away. And I had cash in there. I had an additional ID, and then I had a pretty sizable pocket knife. I'm like, you know what? Let me grab that as well. Do we have our cell phone at the time? 2011? Gosh, I can't remember. We had to have. Anyway, so I grabbed that and I go, well, if I'm going to take anything, let me grab this. At least I could defend myself or cut out of whatever they're going to tie us up with. It sounds pretty like I'm really paranoid, but I am in a foreign country, right? Especially in Egypt. And it's crazy. When you land there, there's no police force. There's military people walking around, but it's kind of chaos. Things have happened. And the revolution happened earlier in the year, and we thought it'd cool down, but it's still kind of a little bit crazy. I get in the back of the car. I look over my colleague, like, dude. I look up, I'm up and down, like, oh, you're wearing a suit. Way to be incognito, man. You're standing out like a sore thumb. The other two guys that had met us, they jump in the front, and of course, they hit the gas pedal. Like, we need to go 120 miles an hour out of the airport. I'm like, okay, well, great. I'm never going to see my family again. So glad I, flew 36 hours to hop in a car. And who knows? A couple Americans get kidnapped, and what appears to be a wealthy businessman next to me. So off we go, and we're headed towards Alexandria from Cairo. I don't know how many miles it is, but I was thinking, like, hey, it would be cool to see the pyramids. No. Didn't get a chance to see that because we're going so fast. It's kind of dusk. It's going into the evening, and bad thoughts are going through my brain. Anyway, we get up into Alexandria. Seems like we're going to where we're supposed to be going. It's where the kind of the base is and things like that. And lo and behold, there's actually a Four Seasons hotel, and we're heading towards it because we don't have the. They were going to take care of all the accommodations. That's kind of the deal when you're traveling and doing that. The people that are hosting you, they kind of take care of everything, which is another. I think it's just a bad idea in general. If any of you are traveling, don't have somebody take care of your, unless it's in a really safe place and you know the contact. Don't have them take care of transportation. Oh, don't worry, we got your accommodations taken care of. You just don't know what it's going to be, let alone if it's safe, let alone being in a country that just had a revolution at night with people you don't know. Well, we speed sorry, sped right past that Four Seasons that looked amazing, and down the street. I'm like, oh, great. How come, can we just turn back there? I'd like to stay there. My colleague's kind of been quiet for a while, kind of looking around like he has no clue where we're going. And about 5 minutes later, we take a couple of quick turns down a street, and we pull up to a nondescript, about 4-story building. Nothing outside, no anything. Out front is kind of a big kind of cul-de-sac, almost like a roundabout. And there's just nobody around. It's at night. I don't know what the exact time it is, but it's kind of late. The guys hop out and say, hey, go inside. We're going to get your bags. I'm like, get our bags to go where? Inside of this abandoned building? And at that point, my friend is like trying to talk to them, like, oh, well, hey, we can just go back over there to this, that nice hotel. Oh, no, don't worry. This is so taken care of. Don't worry about it. They shuttle us inside. There's somebody sitting on the stairs that, vagrant or homeless person, kind of look at us like, who is this? We go up 2 or 3 flights of stairs with all of our gear, which there's hundreds of pounds of gear with these inside these Pelican boxes, and go inside It almost looked like a prison cell, the inside of a just white-walled prison cell room. They shove us inside there, and hey, get some sleep. We'll contact you in the morning. And we go inside, and there's just a couple of beds. It's freezing cold. The window's open, and you could hear shouting outside the window because, unbeknownst to us, at night they're kind of celebrating because of the revolution. And the government's been removed, or the previous government, and we can't seem to shut the window because it's cold. We hadn't eaten anything, and we kind of just sit there on the bed and like, what just happened? Did we fly all this way just to get shoved in this random building in a room in the middle of Alexandria? Shit. Well, we don't really sleep that well. Like I said, it was pretty cold out, and in the morning I'm up early. Like, what are we gonna do? I had already kind of left the room and kind of looked around. There's just nobody anywhere. We make our way downstairs, trying to find. Well, hey, we got to go find some food. It's already the next morning. We haven't heard from anybody, and at that point, we're like, how the hell do we get back to the airport and get out of here? Like, this isn't great. Well, unbeknownst to us, there was one person working there. They happened to be working in the kitchen. And we run into this gentleman, and he speaks kind of broken English, and we figure out how to get some food. And he, of course, oh, don't worry, I'll get you food. And we sit in this kind of a really big dining hall. Nobody's in there, and there's no silverware, there's no anything. He brings out a couple glasses of water, half filled. Kind of looked like it hadn't been washed in a long time, and gave us it looked like just kind of runny eggs with a hot dog on it and a piece of bread. And it was good. We hadn't eaten in a very long time, and so we scarfed that down. I avoided the water. I think my colleague, he drank the water. That's later on in the story what happens there, but about 10 minutes later, there's our escorts again. They show up, and all is well. They're ready to take us to the base. And, we're relieved. This is great. Let's get to the base. Let's, all prepare to do this big presentation. And we pile in the car. And we get into downtown Alexandria because we're going to head over to the base where we're going to do this demonstration. We're going to do a presentation for what would be considered like the admiral there. I don't know if it's general or what, but pretty high-ranking officers about what we had, and then also a live demonstration right there in the Mediterranean Sea where they're going to test out the jet boots and things like that. So, if any of you have been to Egypt, you know about this, but when you get to an intersection, there's about 4,000 cars. I don't know where they came from. There's no sense of an intersection other than everybody's trying to push through to get to the other side. And whoever pushes the most with your cars and mopeds, and there's tanks rolling across the street, there's bicycles, people walking, and whichever flow of traffic seemed to pushed the hardest, got through, right? So it was just fascinating. We're just looking at this like, how is this even possible? Nobody directing anything. There's not a roundabout or anything. It's just get through traffic. And they love to communicate with their horn. It seemed like everybody was honking their horn for whatever reason. And even when there was nowhere to go, you gave a couple beeps on the horn. It's super irritating. Here in America, you don't really put your horn on too often. And when you do, you better have a good reason. So after about an hour of driving, we weave through all this traffic and back roads. Like, there's no chance we could ever get back to the hotel if we even tried and know where we were. We finally come upon the base and the gate to the kind of a back entrance. And of course, it's seems like they know each other instantly. We're let in. And there we are. We're on the base, and I was like, okay, here we go. We get all of our equipment out and kind of shuttle it over to where the diving part of it was going to happen. Kind of, they told us, "Hey, stage it over here. You guys come over here, and you're going to give your brief to the general, the main officer." Well, as we go into the building, everything starts to become really, really formal. Like, it's super nice inside this building. The people who greet us in there sit us down. We have this amazing tea. I think it had like 10,000 milligrams of caffeine in it because we're just ramped up and kind of talking story with the people there that had broken English. There's different Egyptian officers that are coming, and some of them knew about my background, so we're kind of talking a little bit. We're kind of in a line of people that are presenting to the main Egyptian officer there, the general. And I remember looking up as we were kind of next to go in, and there was this guy, and he was fiddling with a shoulder-fired rocket. And obviously I'm like, well, that's got to be a dummy rocket. Like, and do they really need to go and try to sell this thing? I don't know what he was presenting to him, but he was kind of going over his talk before the door would open and he would be let in. And he literally was talking about shoulder-fired rocket. And the guy next to him had some sort of hand grenade thing. And there we were with our diving equipment, these jet boosts, this underwater propulsion device that would help their combat swimmers. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy. We're literally arms dealers. So it was just surreal, being there. Anyway, grabbed another cup of tea. Might as well enjoy it while we can. I wasn't really drinking the water so much because it's kind of suspect of it, and there wasn't a lot of bottled water around, so I felt like I was getting dehydrated. Had a pretty bad headache, so I took a lot of the tea. We're up next, and the escort comes out, and oh yeah, Mr. Justin, with the jet boots, and he brings us into this room, and we walk into the room, and there must have been 50 Egyptian officers all sitting there quietly in like perfect formation. And as we walk out in front of them, there's a projector that already has our presentation loaded up on it, and a big, huge screen, almost like you're up on a stage. And it's like somebody shoved us out onto the stage with no preparation. We thought we were just going to meet with a few people. That's kind of how it was in other countries, especially with their special forces. It was very, very laid back, very low key. Well, we get thrown in front of this stoic crowd of officers that are sitting there, and they're not talking to each other. It's okay, it's go time, because the guy with the shoulder-fired rocket had gone, the hand grenade guy had gone, and now we're up with our diving device. And so the light is like on my face, and I'm trying to explain the details. I can't read anybody's expression. I feel like I'm totally bombing this whole thing. I don't know if anybody understands English. I got some video of other combat swimmers using our device, and so kind of a backstory on jet boots. I had linked up with the original inventor of this device, and it's basically just an underwater thruster hooked up to a battery. And at the time, I was working at another company, a government contracting company called SAIC, and we were doing some work with the SEAL team. And I said, "Hey, this thing might have some military application." And I contacted the inventor. We got one of his thrusters and batteries, and it was in really rough shape. I mean, the thing had a lithium battery on the inside, and way back then, I mean, these things were very unstable. It flooded out a lot, but it's still like, man, this thing could work if we did certain things to it, and if every diver could wear one of these. And you basically wear it like a climbing harness. The thrusters are on your thighs, and you could control the speed of the. So I played around with this kind of contraption at the time, which is basically a waterproof thruster with a propeller on the end of it, and it just hooked up to a battery. And there's a thruster on each one of the thighs. And my thought was, This could be a mission enhancement tool for combat swimmers as they swim into a harbor. Hey, that's, that was my job in the past. So this thing, I could really use this, not use it all the time, but if I needed to go up against a current, if I needed to drag stuff underwater, if I needed to do any number of things, having extra power would be great. What if, I injured myself or anyway, all those thoughts are going through my mind at the time, but it took a while to kind of get this thing back up. So after playing around with these things for a while and going through iteration after iteration, finally got them to a working state to where a diver could jump in the water with his partner and they could use it to propel themselves underwater pretty easily. Anyway, it was kind of first of its kind, I brought it right to the SEAL team to start testing it out. Like, hey guys, what do you guys think? Is this something we could use? Let's break it. Let's go through some different versions of it. There was a little dial on your waist to where you could turn it up and move really quick underwater or turn it down. And the learning curve was really, there wasn't really one because it would just push you from the hips and anywhere you moved your head, you would go. Anyway, there's a lot of safety protocols for good reason in the US, and so it can take a while to get equipment out to the operator. Pretty frustrating because you're burning through cash like crazy. I'd found a company that would do the manufacturing, do the engineering to get it up to speed. And I'm on this side of it. It's like, hey, product development and sales and traveling and doing all of that to get this thing out there. And it takes a lot to do. And we've been to a number of countries before that. We started to get orders, which was great. And now we're in Egypt. And there we were presenting to the general of the Egyptian Maritime Special Forces in front of all these officers. Okay, so that brings us to present day. I'm not sure how long the brief lasts, but 20 minutes or so, maybe 30 minutes. No reaction from the crowd. I step off stage and go to my colleague. I'm like, oh, geez, I think we bombed that one. They'll probably buy more of the shoulder-fired rockets than our thing. But all the officers were released because I think we were the last brief. And man, right away, they started talking to us about it, asking tons of questions in very, very good English. And you could tell there was a ton of interest. Because soon after that, we're going to do the demonstration in the water. The key thing with our equipment, the jet boots, is you really got to kind of watch it in action and you got to use it to really go, oh, yeah, that is really good. This thing is going to be awesome. If not, you're kind of like, well, I don't know if we need something like that. And so on these demonstrations, we'd always make sure, hey, do you have a pool that we can go to? Do we have access? The pool's the best because it's guaranteed clear water, and all the generals and everybody can stand there and watch and listen to the special operation divers when they're using it, talk about, hey, yeah, we could use it for this. And if they need it, well, the higher ups, they can pull the trigger and buy it. Okay. Well, that's not the case here. We didn't have a pool. And I was kind of like, dang it, this is not good. But they had set us up to, for their divers to use it in the Mediterranean, which was right there. We were right on the coast. And I said, okay, well, we'll take whatever we can get. A pool would be best. So, we all go down to the pier. A couple of their divers get on all their gear. They put on a rebreather. They get all jocked up and everything that they have. And they plan to go out to this one buoy, report in, go over here. And it wasn't really well set up because of the language barrier and it was kind of windy, so the water was kind of choppy. And I remember the time that I would usually get in the pool, we had a spare set that I would wear, and I would kind of demonstrate a little bit. And I'd put the set on, and I was standing at the end of the pier, and I remember looking over, and like two piers down from us, there was like a tanker like emptying. It looked like sewage, like right into this bay. Wasn't necessarily the Mediterranean Sea. We were kind of on on an inlet where the Navy had everything. So the water didn't look great. And I was like, oh man, I am going to get wrecked with this water. But what are you going to do? Everybody's staring at you. You know, you're this former Navy SEAL. You could do whatever and just suck it up. Well, okay. So I jump in. It's about a 10-foot drop into the water, turn on the jet boots. I buzz around a little bit. You can't see much. It's like, well, what are they? And everybody's staring at you. Like I said, the water was kind of choppy. So it wasn't well done. And I just said, hey, have those guys that have them on, jump in and do the dive. Just let's get this thing going. Everybody's kind of getting distracted for whatever reason. The two divers, they jump off the pier into the water. They go underwater and they disappear. And typically you'd come up, you'd give some hand signals to the pier or whatever, and there'd be some communication like, hey, these things are great. Hey, I turned them on. Or sometimes they don't turn them on right, and I got to go over there and turn them on. That's a big reason why I'm in the water. That first initial kind of experience with them. Anyway, they just disappear. And they didn't have a buoy. A lot of times in training dives, you connect a buoy to the diver so you can track where they're going and things like that. Well, there was no buoy. They jumped in and I'm like, oh crap. The first thought that goes through my mind is did they just like sink to the bottom? And like, why would they just not come back up to the surface? They're wearing rebreathers, so you don't see any bubbles, and they're just kind of gone. And I'm just floating in the water looking like an idiot and everybody's staring at me. And within a couple minutes, it's clear they're either off on their little course that they had mapped out, or they just sunk to the bottom. And they're like, well, okay, they must be off on their course. I'm going to climb up this rusty old ladder and get out of the water because it's disgusting. And I need to talk with some of these guys to kind of keep the interest going. I get out of the water, and we all stand there for God, it must have been an hour. The higher ups, the generals, and you know, they're getting served tea and stuff like that. And it just gets windier and crappier. And it couldn't be a worse demonstration in my mind. I'm like, this is going so terrible. And they kind of just get up and they leave. Like nobody's talking about our stuff. They're talking together. It's windy. It's been a long day and they just leave. And I'm left there with my colleague and a couple of the other officers from the military, and we're just kind of staring at each other like, well, what do? We got to stand here till these guys get back, and we're trying to make small talk. Must have been an hour and a half at least. And what do you know, these guys pop up, they don't say a word, they climb up the ladder and get out of the water, they take off all their gear, and everybody leaves. we're standing there like, okay, I guess that's it. I went and found a hose that we could rinse off all the salt water off of our gear. Cause you know, I mean, that's kind of it. We're gonna go try to find our way back to the airport. We rinse off all the gear and we box it up, and, our escorts come get us. The place is a ghost town now. I don't see anybody. Like literally they all just like kind of left and went home and didn't tell anybody. Didn't even tell each other, and the place is a ghost town. It's just us with our gear. Usually you would have time to kind of let the stuff dry. Well, we had to shove it right in the Pelican cases, throw it in the back of the truck, and we're heading through the crazy traffic back to our hotel. And long story short, we get back there. There's no communication. We tell them what time our flight is. Well, we have to leave Alexandria to get back to Cairo, and we have a pretty early flight. I think we fly through Turkey or we fly through Germany. I forget where we connect through. Maybe we get all the way back to Paris. But we got a pretty early flight. And the guy was like, well, we have to leave like at 2 a.m. from Cairo to get you to the airport at that time because you got to get there 3 hours ahead. You have all this military equipment. It's going to take you a while to get through clearance and customs and all that stuff to get out of the country. We got to leave like at 2 a.m. And it was the most surreal thing because the revolution had happened, and there is the military is out on the streets, like there's tanks out there, because the police had disbanded at the time because it was so corrupt. Like there's no police, there's supposed to be checkpoints and stuff like that, and it was just all abandoned. We hop in this, of course, undersized car for all of our stuff, and we just drive 1,000 miles an hour down what I thought was like the Autobahn, and we're just going. And you look around, and you're like, what are all these? Do people's lights not work here? Like, they just look like their parking lights are on when cars are coming at us and we're passing cars. And even our driver, like, hey, man, do you have your lights on? Like, he didn't speak any English, but he's kind of nodded at me. Oh, yes, don't worry. God willing, we'll get there. And if any time I thought I was going to die, it was on the way from Alexandria down to Cairo, just flying through these checkpoints that were abandoned, but we're going over speed bumps at an ungodly speed. And I managed to get out of the driver. Oh, so why don't people have their lights on? Like, how do you see them? Oh, they don't like to turn the lights on because it runs down the battery. And I kind of just looked at my colleague and I'm like, we scratched our head, like, what? That's not how that works. Maybe if their alternator doesn't work, but then we just went quiet and like, okay, we're either gonna die or we'll get to the airport. We get to the airport on time and we go through the process of getting into customs. Well, the effects of me getting in that dirty water started to hit about 20 hours into my return back home. And I remember walking through the front door, going to the living room, laying on the couch, pulling covers over my head, and not waking up for like 3 days. I think my wife said at the time, like, well, I didn't know what I'd have had to carry to the hospital. I had like Montezuma's revenge. He's just puking out of everything, shaking, can't even see straight. I should have probably gone to the doctor. Who knows what bug I got? But like 3 days later, I just like come out of it. Like I'm coming out of some kind of like sweatshop or something. I don't know. But that was my trip to Egypt and all the lessons learned there. Don't let other people manage your travel when traveling to other places. Make sure you're prepared. Have American currency, including other currencies of countries around you, if you need to go to those other places. Make sure you got a credit card and make sure you know who you're linking up with. That is really key. And don't drink the water. Drink only bottled water and just kind of have your head on a swivel. There's definitely some stupid things we did at the time. The bright spot in the whole thing, the Egyptian government ended up buying a couple years later, they ended up buying a ton of jet boots. And that was great to see that actually that all worked and they loved them because they're terrible divers. They're terrible at all of that. They don't have the discipline underwater, so they need these things to even make it underwater. So sorry for the extended story. Thought you'd like that trip to Egypt in the midst of the revolution happening in Libya and in Alexandria at the time. All right, see you.